Broadcasting from New York City, podcasting to the world, you're listening to the intersection of politics and culture with Mark Riley.
Hello, this is The Intersection, the intersection of politics and culture. My name is Mark Riley. We're so glad you're with us on this podcast for our 10th episode. We're going to start out talking about New Zealand, the President of the United States, and white nationalism. Folks, the horror of that massacre in New Zealand, which, by the way, for those of you who don't remember this, took place at two different Muslim houses of worship. It killed, at last count, 51 people. It was just beginning to sink in when Donald Trump, the President of the United States, told the nation that he didn't think white nationalism posed a particular threat globally. This, even though the person who is now in custody for committing this massacre is a self-avowed white nationalist. And we have seen, I don't even want to say the fruits of white nationalism, but we have seen the destruction that white nationalism has caused. Not to say they're the only ones. There are Muslims who have caused destruction. There are different people who have caused destruction. There are evangelicals, or people who call themselves evangelicals, who have caused destruction. But in this case, the situation was a white nationalist decided to shoot up two mosques and kill better than four dozen people. That's the long and the short of what went on. And when Donald Trump, our president here, was asked about white nationalism, his thing was it was a relatively small group of people. He doesn't think white nationalists created danger to the United States. Now, he believes in his heart of hearts, apparently, that people coming over the southern border into the United States cause a huge problem. In fact, such a problem, he had to declare a national emergency to build a border wall. But white nationalism doesn't pose, I guess, for him, nearly as much of a threat. Now, that Donald Trump would react this way should come as absolutely no surprise to anyone who's followed him as president. Donald Trump knows that a cohort, not all of his supporters, not maybe even half, but there is a cohort of his supporters who believe in white nationalism. They have been stoked by social media, by broadcast cable channels, the whole nine, into believing that somehow white people in this country are in some sort of existential danger from forces they don't always even name, and in some cases, in my judgment, don't even know that much about. But Trump certainly believes that this cohort of white nationalists that follow him, that they are people that he needs politically. Therefore, he's not going to talk bad about them. He's not going to perhaps do what a lot of people think he ought to do, which is to condemn them outright and say quite simply, if you're a white nationalist or a white supremacist, I do not want your support. I disavow your support. And certainly, the people that back Donald Trump, who are white supremacists, want to reinforce that supremacy by whatever ugliness is at their disposal, including violence. Not all the time, but they have shown that they are not above using violence. What's ironic about the white nationalist, white supremacist movement, and we'll get into at some future date why nationalist is used and not supremacist in many cases, but why, and why is it that there is this fear? Why is it that this whole notion of a threat from without is reason enough to do some of the things that white nationalists, in fact, do. It is not new. It is a movement. But what's ironic about it is that whites are under attack by them, blacks, Latinos, Asians, yes, Jews and Muslims. There's a very interesting and, in my judgment, incisive article in The Atlantic by a guy named Adam Serwer that references a book by an American white supremacist named Madison Grant. It was written in 1916. The book is called The Passing of the Great Race. Now, what you have to understand about the year 1916 in American history was that white supremacy was a given. There weren't a whole heck of a lot of arguments. There were rigidly and legally segregated facilities throughout the South and in some places in the North, in point of fact. White supremacy was reinforced at every turn, including at the end of a hangman's rope. That's right. That's the 1916 we're talking about. You know, a lot of people seem to want to ignore or forget what America was like in 1916. And that our nobility as a nation began with the founding fathers and stretched all the way across to the year 2019. And they like to sweep under the rug some of the crap that people believed and promulgated into the 20th century. This is one of them, The Passing of the Great Race. It was a favorite of, among others, Adolf Hitler. American politicians at the time, including former presidents Teddy Roosevelt, Warren Harding, and Calvin Coolidge, all sang the praises of this book, The Passing of the Great Race. And by the way, that book leaned very heavily on race science to prove its point that white America at that time was under threat, not from black people, they certainly included black people, but were under threat from other white people. In some cases, from some of the same white ethnic groups that now fear people of color and want border walls to be built. That's right. At that time, there was a delineation between Aryans and, for example, people that were from the Mediterranean. There were delineations among white people. There were delineations among whites that came up in Scandinavia and whites that were from, for example, Ireland. This is not new, ladies and gentlemen. And it was not back then limited to people of color. But now we see that it still goes on. White supremacy, white nationalism is as American as apple pie. It has survived despite the election of a black president who was elected, by the way, twice. It cannot be legislative or regulated out of existence, nor can it be beaten out of people who uphold it as a doctrine. It can certainly be made more difficult to promote through violence, but that's the one thing that Americans seemingly fear more than black people, and that's the loss of guns, the inability to own and use firearms. Now, you know, I have a particular position about guns. It's not a mainstream position. I don't think anybody should have a gun, quite frankly, but we live in a society that was built on the gun. Believe me, they couldn't have killed off the indigenous people if they didn't have guns. And that has carried through over the years to the point that people now believe that in order to defend themselves against the government that, by the way, they elected, they must have these guns. Or, again, because they fear people of color banging on their doors, and I don't know. I don't know what they think people of color are going to do. But again, white supremacy is as American as apple pie. New Zealand, in the aftermath of this massacre, got serious about guns. This president, the American president, has no interest whatsoever in looking at how to keep guns out of the hands of people who would use them against their fellow human beings. It's not in Donald Trump's arsenal. It's not in Donald Trump's priority list. It's not. And the fact of the matter is that a gun culture, along with the spread of an ancient and discredited notion of white nationalism, ensures more death and destruction around the world. And you can slice it any way you want it. You can say it was this group against that group, or this guy who believed in this belief system attacked an innocent group of people. But it will continue to happen until we become serious about how we're going to deal with these problems, how we're going to deal with these issues. When you have elected officials in this century talking about, well, what's the problem with white nationalism? What's the problem with calling it that? As one politician, Steve King, who we've talked about before, he's been down front about it. He sees no problem with white nationalism or white supremacy, for that matter. All fine with him, all good. Well, it's not all good with thinking people. It's not all good with people who have some sense of humanity outside of looking in a mirror at themselves. And until we get right about that, there are going to be more New Zealands. There are going to be more massacres in the United States, like in Pittsburgh. And it's going to be different groups of people. And folks will sit up and say, well, I'm not Jewish, or I'm not Muslim, or I'm not black, or I'm not this, or I'm not that. So it really doesn't pertain to me. But you see, when the world looks at us, it does pertain to us. And if we have any sense at all, we will recognize that and attempt to address it. I find it continually amazing that a country that would elect a Barack Obama not once but twice to office still has this problem of white supremacy. I guess maybe people thought, well, you know, we'll just keep quiet about it till he's out of office, and then we'll elect a guy who, I guess, blows every dog whistle known to mankind, and the nationalists just jump up, you see? There's a point at which we are going to have to be serious about ourselves. We are going to have to take a long, self-reflective look at our civilization. We have to acknowledge, and I've said this before, we're going to have to acknowledge some of the stuff that has been very difficult up until now for us to wrap our brains around. And then we have to move forward. And hopefully, we will move forward in a direction that says to people, we are aiming for the highest good for the largest number of people. I don't know why it's so difficult for folks to understand how that works. But it seems as though the notion that I for me and later for you can somehow, some way, still hold some currency in this society. And I feel for the lives of those people who died in New Zealand. I mean, I really feel that because it's so unnecessary. It's tragic, yeah, but it is so ridiculously unnecessary. And it's going to happen again. It's probably not going to happen in New Zealand. It'll probably happen here somewhere in the United States. And depending on how many people die, we will term it either a massacre or a tragic shooting or any number of other things. Again, depending on who the shooter is and depending on who the victim is. And we will attempt to obviate the obvious, because that's just too cliched. But the fact of the matter is, we are going to have to take a look at systems that we have been very, very hesitant and maybe even embarrassed to look at before. And one of the things that is, for me, a part and parcel of this is that we have to look at it as Americans, not white Americans, Jewish Americans, Muslim Americans. We have to look at this as Americans. And maybe once that happens, we'll be in a position to try and fix it. Stay with us. I am so happy you are here listening to this podcast. The 2020 elections are around the corner. What issues are going to be important to you and your candidate? Send me an email, mark@markreillymedia.com. Back momentarily.
Listen, discover, think. It's Intelligent News Analysis with Mark Reilly.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Reilly. For updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Reilly Media, and don't forget to comment because your opinions are important to me. Our second topic today is weed and social justice, which for some people may be like oxymorons or why are you putting them in the same sentence? There are now 10, I think maybe even 11 states that have legalized the recreational use of marijuana. There are other states that have allowed the medicinal use of marijuana, but there are now, I believe, 11, because I think Michigan just legalized it this last midterm election. Several states are now considering making weed legal. Some of those states had governors who in the past opposed legalization, but now have seen the light. It's not all of them. Some of them are very cautious about legalizing marijuana. And maybe they should be. But it is a tide. And sooner or later, the nation will. It's not going to be like prohibition. You know, prohibition, when it happened, they had constitutional amendments, one that outlawed alcohol and the other that repealed the constitutional amendment that outlawed alcohol. So people were allowed to drink again. And, you know, some of the stuff from those times would be instructive for people to look at as they debate the question of marijuana legalization. As smoking grass just for the hell of it loses what was for a long time, certainly during my lifetime, a social stigma, there are some lawmakers who want to go even further than simple legalization of recreational marijuana in particular states. Nationally, by the way, they want the records of those convicted of simple possession expunged. We're talking, again, across the country about hundreds of thousands of otherwise law-abiding people. New Jersey Senator and presidential candidate Cory Booker has introduced something called the Marijuana Justice Act, which would legalize weed nationally as opposed to doing it state by state, and expunge criminal records. Why is getting rid of these past convictions so important? That's something that is worth contemplating and worth discussing. This may be unbelievable to some of the younger listeners to this podcast, but when I was a kid, marijuana smoking was taken very, very seriously under the law. There were situations where people were locked up for 10 years, for possessing a joint or two. Collars were easy for people whose job it was to enforce the law, especially in cities like New York. You know, you catch somebody walking down the street smoking a joint, you bust them, even if they don't go to jail for a long period of time. And the times when people were locked up for 5 or 10 years, that was in states in the South in many cases. And in most cases, blacks and other people of color went to jail far more frequently than whites for marijuana possession, even though consumption was and is, to this day, roughly equal. That's why people want these arrests expunged. If you go back far enough, you'll find that the push to make marijuana illegal was based largely on the fears of whites of what blacks would do if allowed to use without any kind of restriction. In other words, anti-weed forces used the fear of black people to accomplish their goal of making marijuana illegal. There are some people, by the way, even today, that want to maintain illegality even if their states make recreational use legal. Nassau and Suffolk counties on Long Island in New York both are contemplating an opt-out, and New York State hasn't even made marijuana for recreational purposes legal yet. Now, the approaches they have are interesting because they'll tell you there's not enough research, even though there's been the ability to do research on the effect of marijuana for generations at this point. They don't have enough information. There's still people that promote the gateway argument that people who start using marijuana will end up on opioids or doing something horrible. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding in states, ironically enough, that have already legalized recreational marijuana. A lot of the stuff that people were sounding the alarm about has not happened in states like Colorado and other places where it's legal. State of California made it legal. And by the way, these states, certainly Colorado, and California is going to cash in like nobody's business by legalizing recreational marijuana. Not because, you know, the state is full of weed heads. That's not necessarily the point. The taxes they will be able to levy on the sale of marijuana in California, which, by the way, is, for those of you who don't know this, California is the perfect place to cultivate and grow cannabis. Perfect. So if they keep that up and suddenly you have businesses that spring up, legal businesses that are able to legally sell it, and the state collects their tax, whatever that may be, that's going to add a whole lot of money to California's coffers. A lot of money. And I think that there are other states that are looking at that and thinking to themselves, well, wait a minute now. If California and Colorado and these other places are cashing in, why should we not cash in? Now, there have been referenda in various states. Ohio, as an example, a few years ago, voted not to legalize recreational marijuana. So, you know, the states, there are states that have different attitudes about weed. And I would be honest with you and say that maybe we ought to look seriously at whether or not a state must be forced to legalize recreational marijuana, which I assume they would be under this Marijuana Justice Act. All I know is that this was an evolution over a very long period of time. I was relatively young the first time I saw the movie Reefer Madness, which was made in 1936, I believe it was. And it had an extraordinarily stereotypical view of what happens to people, particularly young people, because the people that were featured in this film were young people. And, you know, the moral depravity, the problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was something that I imagine scared the bejesus out of an entire generation of people, especially young people. And there are people now who are in their 70s, maybe in their 80s a little bit, who saw that movie as a young person, and their attitude about marijuana was formed then and there. And it's never changed. But if you go back and look at the work that was done by people in law enforcement to make marijuana illegal in the first place, because it wasn't always, and if you look at how they did that, and the whole, do you want black people sleeping with your, black men sleeping with your daughters? That's what'll happen if you allow black people to smoke marijuana. Now, y'all may think I'm crazy. Y'all may think I'm out of my mind saying something like that. It's true. You can look it up. Don't take my word for it. Look it up. And against that backdrop, and against the backdrop of people, you know, the NYPD in New York City had a very interesting sort of sleight of hand they did with people, you know, to be able to bust them, you know, because there was a thing called stop, question, and frisk. So they would stop a kid that had a backpack on, and they didn't know whether the kid had anything on him or not. They really didn't. But they could get the kid to incriminate himself by saying, listen, we're going to go through your bag. If we find anything, you're in deep trouble. So if you got anything, let us know. The kid, believing all this, says, okay, well, I got like a few grams in a bag in my thing. And he pulls it out and they bust him right then and there. You see, that's how people were able to rack up the kind of money that they racked up in terms of marijuana interdiction, marijuana prevention, the whole nine yards. And all of that will, God help me for the cliche, go up in smoke if weed is made, recreational use of weed is made legal. Now, I'm not Pollyannish enough to think that there aren't potential problems with nationwide recreational marijuana legalization. And by the way, when they say recreational, I always wonder what they mean by that. You know, is that like, okay, well, I'm just going to toke up. Okay. Do they mean recreational? Because I never hear people talk about the recreational use of alcohol. I don't. And you know, alcohol, to me, can be, under certain circumstances, far more dangerous than marijuana. But, you know, I think that there are ways to regulate it. First of all, to keep it out of the hands of young people. There's nothing wrong with setting a minimum age to purchase and use. And if there are people who are selling to underage kids, throw the freaking book at them. I don't have a problem with that. But I think that for adults who are of sound mind and body, to be able to use this drug, it's not what it once was. We now have a different culture and a different way of looking at these kinds of drugs. And again, I don't think anybody believes that prolonged marijuana use is going to lead you to heroin or opioids or whatever. Maybe there are some statistics that prove me wrong. I do see some scholarly articles in some quarters that argue vehemently against legalizing recreational marijuana. In some cases, they say we don't know enough yet. In some cases, they just believe that the scientific evidence is that weed is damaging to people. Sometimes they put it in the context of young people when they shouldn't, but they'll say damaging psychologically, socially, whatever, to young people, and that it should not be made legal because of that. And listen, people are entitled to their opinion about this. But I think an informed opinion, meaning you know the history of marijuana illegality. You know the numbers of people who were locked up who are never going to have their records expunged because they're dead. There is something to answer for here. And there's an ability and an opportunity, more importantly, for the country and individual states, depending on whether they want individual states to legalize or whether they want to do it nationally, there is the opportunity to do the right thing by the people who were convicted because there was this, should I call it a predilection? To arrest black people for marijuana possession and not at anywhere near the rate of white people. And this is happening in cities and towns all over America. Happened in New York. New York's supposed to be one of the most sophisticated, quote, liberal, unquote, cities in America. And it happened for years in New York. And it's time that the right thing was done. And I wonder, do you support? Where are you on this? Do you support the total legalization of marijuana across America? Do you support expunging records of people convicted of pot possession? I mean, I'm just here talking to you. I'd love for you to tell me. You know, is this something that would be a big deal in the 2020 elections? They had four other people sign on as sponsors, four other people running for president sign on as sponsors to Cory Booker's bill. So this is something that progressive presidential candidates obviously feel they can get behind. So I'd love to hear from you on my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Please do not be shy. Tell me, do you support legalization of recreational use? And do you support record expungement, getting rid of the criminal records of people who've been convicted of marijuana possession? Stay with us. This is The Intersection. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Our last segment today involves television. Now, I know, you know, it's supposed to be culture. Some people argue that there is no culture on television. I would argue to the contrary, but be that as it may, there's a TV war going on right now. Cable versus streaming versus antennas versus satellite. 2018 marked the first in this continuing war for the hearts and minds of TV viewers. Streaming services pumped out more original content than broadcast and cable networks. That's a first. Streaming services, you know, the Netflixes of the world. This means, in theory, more shows for you, the consumer, the viewer, to choose from. But it also brings up the question, does it still make sense for you to get your television over the air or from cable sources? Maybe it doesn't anymore. I mean, there's Hulu, there's Sling, Amazon Prime, DirecTV Now, YouTube. I could go on and on because there's a lot of them now. Do any of them offer what a cable package offers? And please forgive me, because I'm real ignorant about this. I don't know the answer to these questions I'm about to ask. We have in the past, we get our television through cable. We also get our internet through cable. We also have a landline, which we almost never use, that we get from the same cable service. It's not cheap. And, you know, we my wife in particular, because she pays the bills, is saying more than once, damn, I wish there was a way we could really, like, do something about the cost of all of this cable stuff, all of this television stuff. Now, I must say, I am not the world's biggest TV watcher. I'm really not. I don't experiment with some of the new channels that are out here. I have certain things that I do watch, some cases for laughs, in some cases because I'm passionate about them. I am a huge fan of what the world calls football and we in the United States call soccer. That is, for me, one of the difficulties in switching over to a streaming service, but that's another point for another day. There are younger people, and not just younger people, but there are people who say that the answer to that question, can you really get your TV without using over-the-air or cable sources? And their answer is yes. In some cases, hell yeah. They say they can cut the cord without batting an eye. If they want local channels that these services don't offer, all they have to do is buy a digital antenna, and at the like top price, $40. Here's the problem for an aging boomer such as myself. Am I giving away my age? I guess I am. Our cable also includes the internet, and disengaging from cable without doing the same for the internet appears to be difficult. Again, I could be wrong about this. It seems that this is the way the cable services grab you by the short hairs. And by the way, they're kind of, you know, what they do is bring you in at a certain price, okay? Let's say for the sake of argument, they'll bundle cable, phone, and internet for $80 a month. And that $80 is guaranteed for a year or two or whatever. And then once you've settled in and stopped paying attention, you see that these bills start rising and they continue to rise. So next thing you know, the $80 you were paying as the introductory offer has gone up to $120 for the same service, mind you. And if you're like me, you don't necessarily want or want to settle for the basic package. You want to get some stuff. Like for me, because I watch British football, I need to get NBCSN. Also found out to watch the FA Cup, which is one of their competitions. I have to get ESPN Plus and pay an extra like $5 a month or whatever it is. If I want to watch La Liga, which is the Spanish soccer league, or as another example, Serie A or any of them, I have to go to some of the more esoteric channels. And I have no clue whether the Slings and the Hulus and the Amazon Primes even carry those programs. And then you see other advertisements, particularly cable advertisements, where they say, oh, no, I got whatever it is, but I can't get ESPN. I can't get ESPN2. I can't get any of these streaming, you know, any of the sports channels that I live and die for. Well, you know, I like ESPN. It's fine. But that's not where I watch most of my sports, at least, you know, at some time. March Madness, I'll watch a little basketball, college basketball. They also carry professional games, so I'll watch them, at least parts of them. But it seems as though disengaging is difficult. And my guess is that the cable services make it difficult. I have heard of situations, people have told me that there are scenarios where if you call the cable company and tell them, listen, I'm terminating my service, they will make you an offer of something much less expensive. They'll say, well, like, what are you paying now for what you have? They'll say, all right, well, we can knock that down a little bit. That's apparently not the norm, but it can, under certain circumstances, happen. So the long and the short of this for me is just, does it make sense to disengage? Okay. We have one of the Amazon Fire Stick or whatever, and we can get Netflix. I don't watch enough episodic television for Netflix to be a particular draw for me. I know they have some good shows. I hear that they cut off shows that are good shows. They cancel them. But it's not going to rock my world if I never watch Netflix. No big deal. But for some people, and particularly young people, my daughter, who's just turned 22 at the beginning of the month, she watches, when she comes home for vacation, she doesn't even turn her television on. She watches everything on her laptop. Now, I wouldn't think that that would be, you know, prime or primo viewing, because a laptop is much smaller than a TV screen. But she's cool with it. She has no problem with it. And she watches whatever mix of television content she wants on her laptop. So as far as I'm concerned, maybe there is a way to do this differently. And I know that some of you who are listening to this podcast may well be cord cutters yourself. So my thing is to you, how do you do it? What works best for you? And I've seen a number of articles, some of which argue that with all of the content that's out here, with all of the upheaval and this article says chaos in the streaming services, it's eventually going to go back to cable services as the best buy. Now, there are others who would tell you, ha ha, you must be out of your mind, that cable is never going to be a better buy than putting together, cobbling together different streaming services that offer you the programming that you want. And in theory, getting rid of programming you don't want, which is important. I mean, my wife said to me earlier today, I went from 101 to 5 something on the cable system, and there was nothing there, nothing that interested her whatsoever. Now, I would think that would be a problem. But I guess, and see, this is the thing, you're paying for all of those channels that nothing is on. Nothing. And maybe it is time to look at this just a wee bit differently in terms of how I consume anyway and how my family consumes televised content. Is it worth it? Should we take the plunge? Obviously, if I could get all the channels I watch for less money, I'd do it in a heartbeat. I'd be nuts not to. I'm just not sure that can actually happen. So help me out here, podcast listeners. If you've cut the cord, hit me up and let me know how it is working for you. Okay? That's very simple. You can hit me up at my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Don't be shy. Tell me what your cord-cutting experience has been or whether you have ever contemplated cord-cutting. And by the way, whether you agree with me or disagree, let's have a conversation. Post your comments to my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Thanks again for listening to this podcast. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Till we meet again, please stay well.